failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. I flew into Seattle last week and then took a bus on up to Vancouver, Canada. I was real careful to make sure I wasn't going to do a Timothy Leary, so to speak, and carry any contraband into the nation of Canada. When we got to the border station, they pulled me aside, took me in a separate room, quizzed me about my criminal history, and in the long run, they told me that it looked like I had been arrested for larceny back in 1970, and they weren't going to let me in. So I asked, 35 years without any problems, and yet I can't get in the country? And the border guard, lady, she was real nice and said, I'll tell you what, you come on in this time, but get you some paperwork next time you come back to Canada to show that you're not a criminal. The bus driver was a nice guy as well, and he took me all the way to 307 West Hastings to the BC Marijuana Party bookstore, the home of Pot TV, Cannabis Culture Magazine, and which serves as the base for four people fighting extradition to the United States. As I gathered my gear together, who should walk through the door but Mr. Richard Cowan?
Good afternoon. Welcome to Vancouver.
Well, thank you for that. I feel it's a very welcoming place. The snow this morning, I hear, is a bit of a rarity, but nonetheless, it seemed like a great town.
It really is a very interesting city, and of course, obviously, everybody thinks about it as Vansterdam and the very liberal marijuana policies, which in some ways is justified, in some ways isn't. For example, it's very hard to get arrested here for possession of marijuana. On the other hand, the police have been quietly going around and closing down a number of very discreet sellers who have been selling, in some cases, for 5 years or more. One guy at an office building downtown, another at a popular youth gathering place that where you used to go up and put a quarter in the jukebox and stand around and look cool, and they had even had a house dealer. That's gone. So it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on here sometimes, because there are, I think, factions within the Vancouver Police Department. Some are narcs, in the full meaning of that word, and some are really honest law enforcement officials who recognize that among Vancouver's many problems, marijuana is not one of them. And there is still only one medical outlet here, the Compassion Society, which has been in business for a very long time. And the city needs several. That San Francisco, of course, which is about the same size as Vancouver, has something like 40 clubs. And it is there's no reason to think that Vancouver couldn't support a dozen or more clubs, but there's only one, and they generally have more than they can handle. So there's a need for more tolerance, even in Vansterdam.
Now, this morning I saw the headlines, government shake-up, the liberals are being challenged, and perhaps a new government. What is all this about?
Well, Canadian politics are a long story, but the fact is, the Canadian parliamentary system, they had a vote of no confidence, so that they have to go to the polls at the end now, the end of January. The so-called marijuana decrim bill, which is a phony bill, died with the parliament because they've been talking about it for years, some we might say decades, and yet they, the so-called Liberal Party never follows through on this. But it's just as well, frankly, because it's a very bad bill. They would give police discretion to issue fines instead of arresting people, and would increase the penalties for growing, even though the maximum penalties are rarely enforced now. But overall, it's a bad bill, and I think it wouldn't even have gotten through the Canadian Senate, which is another story. But I think that what we're going to see, we need to wait and see what kind of government we're going to have. The Liberals are a centrist party. The Conservatives to the right tend to be social conservatives. The New Democratic Party on the left is tends to be socially much more liberal, and the head of the NDP has more or less endorsed legalization, and several prominent members of the NDP are in favor of legalization. And oddly, we may end up with a very strange left-right coalition after the next election, which will be at the very least fun to watch, and will, I think, prevent a bad marijuana bill from going through Parliament.
What lessons might Canada share with the U.S.?
Well, I think that, frankly, it's obvious that low levels of enforcement are possible in terms of possession. Vancouver, as I said, it's very hard to get arrested for possession, and that is without any change in the laws. So the fact is that police departments every place effectively have the discretion not to arrest people because they have to have priority. It would be absurd if a policeman who's riding a parking ticket was, said he couldn't stop to prevent a murder going on down the street because he's busy riding a traffic ticket. That's, that sort of absurdity is, basically the same principle applies in choice of emphasis, because here in Vancouver they have a lot of problems. But they still spend a lot of resources, particularly going after growers, but as I said, also shutting down retailers who were not in any way a problem. So it's clearly, law enforcement has discretion, and they need to use it, and keeping, say, with the laws or initiatives passed in Denver and Seattle and Oakland, that making marijuana possession a low priority for the police. The Seattle will be the people in Seattle. The police admit they haven't had any problems as a result of that.
So I walked to the back of the bookstore, and there I got a chance to interview a beautiful young lady who has got her problems with marijuana and the United States as well. I'm here with Renee Boucher. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Dean. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. For those who may not have heard your story, perhaps why you're here in Canada, tell us a little bit about what happened to you in the U.S.
Sure. I was working in 1997 for a man with cancer and a man with AIDS, and I was basically illustrating a book they were writing on how to grow medical marijuana, and they were researching lots of different strains of marijuana in order to match a strain to different illnesses. And all of their whole garden was legal in California, according to Proposition 215 at the time, the law that passed legalizing medical marijuana there.
You were advised to come to Canada. You've started a new life. You've starting a new future, and yet the U.S. still is after you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the federal authorities ignored the state laws, and they went in and arrested my friends, and they asked me to testify against my friends Peter and Todd. Peter was dying of AIDS and cancer, and Todd has a terminal cancer, so I refused to testify and be part of putting them in prison. So my lawyer advised that I flee the country, and I came to Canada, luckily. I've been here about 7 years now, and applying for refugee status, but my refugee claim was put on hold because the United States is trying to extradite me back to the U.S. to serve 10 to life in a U.S. federal prison. And right now I'm appealing to the Court of Appeals because the B.C. Supreme Court and the Minister of Justice both decided to surrender me. So now the next step is the Court of Appeals, and I return to court, I believe, in March. And we are going to see how they want to treat my appeal, if they want to send me back to the B.C. Supreme Court because the judge there made some errors of natural justice, or send me back to the Minister of Justice because he also made some errors of natural justice as well as some errors of law. So we'll see what happens there. But we do have strong grounds for appeal, about 10 arguments that we're putting forth. And if I don't win at this stage, I'm going to appeal to the Supreme Court, at which time I'll have a year to do that.
Okay, and I look over here on the wall. I see a picture of your beautiful son. You've married. You've started a family. You started a new life here in Canada. Tell us about your situation now.
I did, yeah. Life goes on, as always. And I met a wonderful man, and we were married in December 2001. And we have a beautiful little boy named Shiva, who's going to be 4 in February. He's just so wonderful. We love him very much. He's pretty much everything to us. You know, children are just so beautiful, such a beautiful gift from Spirit. And, my biggest fear definitely is my son's well-being. If I was to suddenly disappear from his life, that would be very devastating for him. And as a Canadian citizen, he does have a right to a mother to bring him up, obviously. And I feel I've done nothing wrong. I was abiding by the laws in California at the time, and the only thing that I did was not agree to testify against two men and I believed in what these two men were doing very much. And I feel, I just feel like I should not be punished for having the courage to stand up for my convictions, so to speak. And I hope, just for the sake of my son, that the Canada will allow me to remain here free.
You work here in a store with good friends, but nearly all of you have threats brought forward from the U.S. government over seeds or medical marijuana. Your thoughts, working amongst people with somewhat similar circumstance?
Yeah, I love having my shop, the Urban Shaman, inside the BC Marijuana Party. Mark Emery was gracious enough to rent me a space in the back of his store, so I rent a small space back here, and I absolutely love it because it's kind of like the center of activism in Vancouver. There's Pot TV here, the BC Marijuana Party, Mark owns Cannabis Culture Magazine and the BC Marijuana Party bookstore, and there's just pretty much it's like a magnet for activists. So a lot of activists come through here and visit here, and I just really enjoy being part of that because I'm an activist myself, pretty dedicated activist now. And it was really horrible for me the day I woke up and I suddenly, you know, I had this phone call that the BC Marijuana Party was being raided and that Emery Seeds was under investigation by the drug enforcement agents. And it was really odd because the raid that happened on Todd and Peter's garden in California happened on July 29th, 1997, and this raid here happened on July 29th, 2005. So it was very strange and surreal for me, and I was just devastated that a day later to find out Michelle Rainey, a good friend of mine, Greg, also a good friend of mine, and Mark, another friend of mine, were all facing extradition and the same thing that I'm facing, which is 10 to life in a federal prison. I just really couldn't believe it, and especially due to the fact that they're Canadian and this is a sovereignty issue. They obviously shouldn't be sent to a U.S. jail to serve time there when their country was basically turning a blind eye to what they were doing. You know, it's cannabis is tolerated in Canada, not yet legal, but I believe it will be legal pretty soon. The government is fighting to pass a bill in British Columbia which will legalize pot cafes and treat drugs in a much more compassionate way. And so this is a really wonderful province to be in, and yet the police and some of the government in Canada, officials in Canada, seem to be going the other direction and kind of fighting against that progress, which is unfortunate. So they're going to appeal, and you know, as much as they need to appeal, and go through the courts and fight it all the way. And I'm totally behind them because I don't want to see my good friends put in a prison either.
Renee is married to a wonderful gentleman who helps her to run the store there at the BC Marijuana Party. His name is Chris Bennett. Tell us about your presence here in Vancouver.
Well, this is a shop started by my wife, Renee Boget, the urban shaman that specializes in shamanic visionary plants, things like Peruvian torch cactus, Hawaiian baby woodrose seed, Salvia divinorum, as well as powerful aphrodisiacs like yohimbe and katuba bark, and all sorts of exotic plants that are from around the world. You know, our feeling is that humanity has an indigenous right to all the plants of the earth, and no government or religion has any right to forbid the use of any plant, and that to do so would be denying humanity of a natural indigenous relationship with nature. And we celebrate that. You know, that's basically what we're all about.
There's a gentleman in the U.S., I think his name is Ron Kaczynski, who currently has a suit headed to the Supreme Court about our rights to grow every seed created by God. Your thoughts on that?
I've been following Ron in his trip down there for a long time, a good decade or so, and he's a great activist. I agree 100% with what he's doing. I've only seen little bits about it here and there, but I fully support the ideals that he's holding there.
Now, you and I have had experiences, have come across knowledge which leads us to believe that these plants in some cases have sacramental religious uses. Your thoughts on there? So you've written some books in this regard.
Yeah, I wrote a couple of books. One that came out in 1995, Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana and Magic and Religion, and another one that came out in 2001, Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible. And they were following historical references to cannabis in a number of cultures and religions. The first one dealt with ancient Assyria, Babylonia, China, India, Africa, and different places where people have naturally recognized cannabis as a sacrament. I'd say it's like the perennial religion, the natural religion. And when you begin to really research this matter, you find out that many of the world's most prominent religions have their inception in cannabis-related revelations of ancient shamans and whatnot. And I include in that group Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, and even Judaism and Christianity.
There are additional ministers, if you will, within the United States, Eddie Lepp to name one, and several dozen others, I think, at this point, that are challenging the U.S. In that regard, the sacramental use of marijuana in particular. Are there similarities going on here in Canada?
Well, the Church of the Universe, of which I'm a reverend, I've been a reverend for about 15 years, has ongoing cases regarding the religious use of cannabis, and they have one in the Ontario Supreme Court, I think, right now, and trying to go to federal court. As well, myself and BCMP lawyer Kirk Tusaw are planning a religious use case here, you know, from here in Canada, a charter challenge, saying that from our reading of the current Canadian Charter of Law, that it already provides instance through freedom of religion for sacramental use of cannabis, and the government isn't following its own mandate by not acknowledging that.
I know that in the U.S., the Native American Church is able to use peyote under religious rites, and there's an ongoing with ayahuasca for similar reasons, I believe. What freedoms for some of these plants that are illegal in the U.S. are available here in Canada?
Yeah. Well, you know, the UDV, the church, the University of Vegetai that had the ayahuasca case before the courts recently run their case. And in regards to peyote, it's interesting to note that in Canada, peyote is totally legal, and they did pass laws against it because to do so, they would have had to provide religious use provisions for the Native American church. And that would open up cases for marijuana use, for Rastafarians and whatnot, to seek provisions here. You know, what we say here in Canada is that, you know, already there's been provisions made for the medical use of cannabis, and so they've shown that a small group of society can use cannabis apart, and everything doesn't fall, you know, fall into decay. So all we're really asking for would be an extension of that exemption program to include people that use cannabis for spiritual purposes.
Well, I did get a chance to talk with Mark Emery that first day, but he wound up getting sick, and I didn't conduct an interview with him during my time in Vancouver. But I did get a chance to talk with one of his co-defendants, and the one who runs the BC bookstore, Miss Michelle Rainey. This is a town that's in flux. The government seems to be changing. Perhaps the focus within the city is changing, but there is progress being made towards drug policy, towards understanding how to better proceed. What is your perceptions in this regard?
I feel, unfortunately, City Council, yes, wants to have progression with the addicts in our community and the drug policy, but the police are not in line. The police are against what City Council wants. Unfortunately, we see now addicts are possibly being arrested in our side streets who are shooting up, and that's not necessary to be arresting addicts. Addicts need help. They need help in our community, whether it's putting them in a facility of some sort so that they can get the help that they need to recover, or whether it is figuring out what is the necessity of their problems to begin with.
And, of course, there is the situation that lingers ever in the background regarding you and Mr. Emery and the seeds. Tell us how that situation stands at this time.
Well, we go to court again on December 8th, and Justice Doam is going to want to set an extradition date hearing. And so myself and Mark Emery and Greg Williams are up against a big, big fight in Canada to keep our sovereignty, and I'm demanding that all Canadians stand beside us and keep us in Canada. There's no reason for the USA to have come into our country to prosecute three activists, marijuana activists, and they're just very angry right now at the progression we've made in Canada.
I think it rather ironic that the U.S., with a now all 91-year history of absolute abject failure in this drug war, is trying to export it to the nation of Canada.
They're trying to export it to other nations, not just Canada. And it is a control situation. Economical and financial loss, in their eyes, if cannabis goes legal. Whether it's in the pharmaceutical, whether it is in the cotton industry. I mean, all you need to do is look back to, you know, 80, 90 years ago in history as to why this was made illegal. Prior to that, one of your presidents, wasn't it, George Washington, was growing hemp, also smoking it. So let's face it, this is an economical and financial loss for certain people that have their investments made into prohibition.
Michelle, you were recently given permission by the Canadian government to grow marijuana. Tell us why that is.
I have Crohn's disease, and I've had Crohn's disease for over half my life. Conventional medicine did not work for my illness, unfortunately. I've had two surgeries, and I have gone through all conventional medicine. Prednisone, Asacol, Demerol, Ativan, Lorazepam, and none of these treatments worked for Crohn's disease, which is inflammatory bowel disease. And I started an experiment 10 years ago and stopped every prescription drug and refused to do any more surgeries and just started using cannabis, and it alleviated all my symptoms from my nausea to my pain, helped with my chronic diarrhea, which is very painful. And in the past couple of months, I was finally able to obtain a federal medical marijuana license in Canada, and this has taken me 7 years to get. I started the process in 1998-99, and my doctors refused because it was too difficult, and the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Canada and the Canadian Medical Association was against giving licenses to grow, to produce, and to possess medical marijuana. Most doctors in Canada, of course, endorse prescription drugs and the benefits of them economically and financially to themselves as well as the pharmaceutical companies. So this has been a long, long journey for me. I'm now 34 years old, and I'm pleased to say I can grow 49 plants. I can possess 10 ounces at a time, and I can store 5 pounds. And that, for me, is history-making.
I think that's rather ironic that you've been indicted in the United States for seeds which could be used to grow the very medicine for which you're now authorized.
I'm in the middle of a political mess. This is all political persecution. I quit a 10-year bank career to prove that marijuana works, especially for a young woman like myself. I've never been on disability or any pension. I've paid my taxes, and I've worked all my life. And I'm not going to have children now just due to the fact that there's a 20% chance I will pass on this illness or this disease to my children. So I'm a very responsible young woman in Canada that I feel it's very unnecessary to be extraditing me in a situation where I've gotten caught up with needing my medicine, and I'm caught up in a mess, an absolute mess, in between two countries that can't decide whether or not marijuana should be legal.
Well, that about does it for our coverage from Vancouver. I want to thank those good folks up there for standing so bravely, so proudly for freedom and for Americans who are afraid to speak up.
My name is Paul DiRienzo. I co-wrote The Avidian Story with Dana Beale, and the book is about this substance from Africa Ibogaine, which is a hallucinogenic drug.
Well, there's some news breaking out of Casper, Wyoming in this regard. Tell us what's going on out that way.
Sure. We found out on Friday a couple in Casper, Wyoming was arrested by federal authorities and charged in a multi-count indictment with conspiracy to import Ibogaine from the Central American nation of Belize. Ibogaine is a hallucinogenic drug isolated from the root bark of a plant known as iboga that grows in the rainforests of the West African nations of Cameroon and Gabon. It was made a Schedule I drug in the early 70s, similar to LSD. But in the 80s, an intrepid group of former drug addicts and their supporters began to claim that Ibogaine has an almost magical ability in the sense of a magic bullet to stop drug withdrawal symptoms and reduce the cravings to do drugs like heroin and cocaine. Thousands of U.S. addicts are treated in guerrilla clinics located in countries where Ibogaine is legal, which is almost every other country in the world. I believe the United States and two or three other countries are the only place where it's illegal. And the treatments have been carried out in the Netherlands, St. Kitts, Canada, Panama, Israel, Belize, and Mexico, and others as well. Ibogaine is ever provided in the United States. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Casper, Wyoming, announced the arrest of a couple, Jack and Karen Haut, H-A-U-T, also from Casper. And according to the assistant U.S. attorney who I spoke with yesterday, Kelly Rankin, he spoke from the Dick Cheney Federal Building in Casper. The couple faces up to 20 years in prison for the alleged Ibogaine conspiracy, also use of a controlled substance, and an unspecified firearms offense. The woman faces 20 years and the man 10. She's the one, I think, associated directly with the Ibogaine. Rankin says that no Ibogaine was ever sent to the couple, and but it's important to know that U.S. conspiracy laws make it illegal to plan a crime, even if the crime is never committed. Rankin added that the defendants were, quote, trying to cure their addiction. And I asked him specifically about that, and he repeated they were trying to cure their addiction and that other addiction issues, that's his words, were involved. He specifically mentioned the addictive narcotic painkiller hydrocodone and methadrin, the street drug we know as speed or crystal meth. Rankin refused to give me any more information, saying that the case is still pending. And folks know that it's being used and in this way by people in order to kick their addiction. So to arrest somebody for trying to purchase the drug that's used to get off their addiction seems exactly what we're talking about when we criticize the drug war and the way the drug war is being approached. That, you know, a drug that could help people get off their addictions is made illegal for no other reason than spite, basically. And then folks, up till now, have been left alone, but now it looks like there's some move afoot to enforce these very draconian laws. As you said, this woman could get 20 years in prison for trying to receive Ibogaine. And there's plenty of people who are going offshore to St. Kitts, for example, Deborah Mash's clinic in Tijuana, Mexico, and other places. Thousands of people have gone overseas to get these treatments. Many people swear by them and are helped by them. And are they going to now criminalize this whole class of people? I don't know. Again, my name is Paul DiRienzo. I'm an independent reporter based in New York City. I have a website, pdr.blogomat.com. That's pdr.blogomat.com.
Well, that's about it for Century of Lies. I hope you'll join us on this week's Cultural Baggage when we'll be reporting from Seattle and the Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs Conference. You know, with Paul's story about Ibogaine, I think once again we've proven that there is just no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data. In fact, there is no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. We have been duped. Please do your part to help end this madness of drug war. Visit our website, endprohibition.org. Prohibido. Istak Ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.